It is Tuesday, May 11th. This is episode 152 of the Token CEO podcast. We are presented by Sports Research. Beach season is almost here. It was, I don't know, it was like 60, 70 degrees in New York today, just enough to like sit in front of the window and swelter when you're like feeling like your armpits are starting to stink. Sports Research calls this pre-beach season, and they're here to help you prepare for it. So whether you did the Cinco de Mayo run with the NRC Running Club, or you just want to get fit and feel great for summer, you can go to sportsresearch.com and find pretty much anything you need. They help professional athletes, not just bloggers and struggling CEOs. They help all sorts of people get ready to feel and be at their best. So you can get at-home workout kits, you can get waist trimmers, you can get supplements, you can get vitamins, you can get my favorite collagen, or you can get Sweet Sweat. And if you go to sportsresearch.com right now and put a stick of Sweet Sweat in your basket and use code NRC, you will get that Sweet Sweat stick for free. You can also get 30% off everything else if you go to sportsresearch.com and use code TOKEN at checkout. All right, we've got a little bit of a random episode for you. We've got Rear Admiral, who is a 14-year and counting Barstool employee. This puts him back at the very beginning when you were technically sort of an employee of Barstool Sports when Dave maybe sometimes paid you. So we've got Rear Admiral. He joins to talk about what he does here, what he thinks about Barstool Sports, and why I should greenlight him and Large going to Ireland to essentially, from what I can tell, is to tour and drink for 2 weeks. Our second guest is Ezra Levine. He is the CEO of a company called Collectible. Collectible is the number one fractional investing platform for sports. That's a mouthful. I feel like you need a business degree to understand what that is. Long story short, what Collectible does is it IPOs iconic sports memorabilia. It allows fans to own shares of iconic sports moments from the past. Before I get into that, I also had a management piece today. So let's start with the management piece. So one of the things that I think is interesting that I sometimes forget about, but I do think weighs on people's minds is what should you do if you're a new manager? So I had a call today with someone from Barstool who is a first-time manager. And one of the things that's kind of funny at Barstool, but I actually don't think that it's unique to Barstool at all, is that all of a sudden people are given managerial responsibility and they're given the opportunity to manage people who formerly used to be their peers. I think in big companies especially, there starts to be this line of people who on paper are managers, but in reality are actually not. And they're mostly not managers because no one has ever given them the authority, the tools, the training, the wherewithal, the empowerment, and the skill set to be able to be great managers. So we have pockets of this through Barstool Sports. I bet if you asked, you know, one in every 10 to 15 people, they would be like, my manager's technically so-and-so, but I don't really ever talk to them. They don't give me work to do. The people I'm actually responsible for are different, or they work in different groups and whatnot. So I had this interesting conversation today about being a first-time manager and what should you do as a first-time manager. And so my first question to the guy was, okay, are you having team meetings? And he was like, no, I haven't done any team meetings yet. And I said, okay. And my second question was like, well, what do the people on your team do every day? And he said, well, they do different things. And I said, well, do you know exactly what their responsibilities are, what they are solely responsible for versus kind of jointly responsible for? And are you clear with them on what you feel their priorities should be or what the standards should be? And are they clear with you on where they need help from you in order to achieve those objectives? Long story short, none of this is happening. And that's not surprising. And it's not a reflection on this person at all. No one has just ever sat down with this person and laid out, hey, here's five things you can do as a new manager. So we had that conversation today, and then it got me thinking that maybe more people need to know about this, or more people could benefit from it. So the exercise that we went through today was, hey, if you're a new manager, get to know the people on your team, have them write out for you what they do every day and what they solely own versus things that they own that they work on with other people. The second thing is to create a team environment. So create a forum where your group knows who everyone else in the group is, knows what they're doing, understands how that relates to what they're doing, and is able to compare themselves and relate to other people in that group. So my point to this new manager was like, hey, why don't you find out what everyone does? Why don't you lay out what your mission is for them? So person A's mission could be a little bit different than person B's mission, which is a little bit different than person C's mission. And then why wouldn't you bring them together every week and talk about where you all are going as a group, what your priorities are, what are best practices that you're learning from one another, what are pitfalls that are facing or have affected you all, and have a real and active dialogue about what you can do together to be better at your jobs. So that we started there. And then the second thing, and this is something we've talked about, I think a couple of times on this pod, is when you're a new manager, you know, one of the things that I think is really hard is that you stop being friends with the people who you manage. And I think this person in particular was like, oof, I'm a little afraid to get out of the friend zone and to move to the manager zone. And I'm like, yeah, being a manager sucks. Like, it's lonely. You have to be the bitch. You have to be an asshole. And you don't have to be a jerk, but you're not going to be everybody's friend. And the most important thing can't be people liking you. And what's more important than being liked is being respected, because you're creating value for these people. You're helping them, you're empowering them, you're supporting and championing them. And you're also laying out a gauntlet of where you think you all should go. The other thing is, you know, I think sometimes new managers are afraid to assert themselves and ask for things. So in this case, like I have, you know, Stu is my go-to guy, one of my go-to people here. And Stu, when Stu gets someone new who's on his team, I think he makes them email him either every day or once a week of like, here's what I did this week. Now, let's be honest, nobody likes that fucking email. Nobody likes writing the like, this is what I did this week. But if you're trying to understand what the people who work for you are doing, are they doing work that matters? Are they doing work of quality? Are they moving, you know, moving the ball forward? Are they moving projects forward? The best way to do that is to create accountability between you and your employee in terms of what exactly are they working on? How are they articulating it? And what is the progress on it? And I think that that's a really good, you know, moderately annoying, I guess, but it's a good way to assert a manager level relationship. And it's a good way to create accountability whereby you both look at each other at the end of every week. Ideally, you'd be having some type of one-on-one, maybe it's every other week. And you're saying, hey, here are the things I laid out for you. And as the employee, you're saying, here are the things I'm working on. And together you're figuring out, how do you get better at those things? How do you give the person more responsibility? How do you course correct when things go astray? So that's the new manager section of this episode. And I think that that's something that just may be relevant to people. I noticed it today, honestly, by chance. I made a comment in the hallway that turned into a one-on-one that made me realize that we're not doing enough here to empower new managers, and also to create accountability and put the onus on new managers to move their people forward. So I thought that that might be something good to cover here. That's that. Speaking of people who think we probably have our shit together, even though we don't always do, AdResults Media is one of the longest standing partners of Barstool Sports. AdResults Media is a performance and podcasting agency. They're one of the best. They've been a stellar partner to us across all of our podcasts. And one of the reasons I'm talking about AdResults Media is, one, we're very appreciative of their partnership. We do some of our best work with their clients like ZipRecruiter or Harry's. And the other reason is that I think one of the things that's really changing is the way brands, you know, Fortune 500 brands, direct to consumer brands, performance only brands, brands that extend across telco, CPG, automotive, packaged goods, QSR, financial services, lifestyle, apparel, you name it. One of the things that brands are facing right now is it's getting increasingly difficult to break through. It is getting increasingly hard to make your marketing message resonate and to have your customers or potential customers understand who you are, pay attention to your message, and engage with it. I'm a huge champion of podcasts. I think podcasts are one of the single best mediums to drive resonance, to drive conversion, and to create engagement with brands. Look at what we've done with Pink Whitney, right? We had an ad read that turned into a social movement, and now it's a top flavored vodka in the world. So I'm a huge proponent of podcasting as a very effective medium for brands. I believe in the authenticity of podcasting. One of the things that we feel very strongly about is that an advertisement should never get in the way of the relationship between a host and a listener. And one of the things I appreciate most about ad results is they appreciate that too. And they do an incredible job, not just with us, but with all of the podcasting platforms, with all of the podcasting networks, to help their brand partners drive results. So if you go to adresultsmedia.com, that's adresultsmedia.com/token, you can learn more about their capabilities. Now that we've talked about being a manager, I don't know if RA, do you guys think RA would be a good manager? I don't know. You can tell me after you listen to this. So first up, we've got Rear Admiral. He is not really our Bruins blogger, kind of our Bruins blogger and co-host of Spit and Chicklets. We're going to kick it to his interview next.
Okay. All right. So we got RA. Hi, RA.
Hi, Erica. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm excellent.
All right. RA, so for the good listeners of the Token CEO podcast, why don't you explain who you are, what you do, how long you've been here, and what you did before this?
Okay. Rear Admiral of the Spit and Chicklets podcast. I've been with Barstool in some capacity of another for 14 years now. 2007, I believe, was my first blog. I was basically an intern for the first 10 of those years. I couldn't get
hired. Portnoy.
I couldn't. Dave wasn't. And to Dave's credit, he did say, I'm never going to hire a Bruins guy. And he still hasn't. So he's a man of his word. But I kept plugging away. And
you lived in Boston. How'd you get a hold of him?
Boston became omnipresent in Boston. I mean, he started, 2003. So I was reading the paper from the early days because I'd be like, this guy can't pick his nose. I don't know how he's got a newspaper. So then he had a Bruins guy. And I'll never forget that it was a college kid. And he called Glenn Murray a playmaker. And this is back then, the comment section was ruthless in a fun way. Now it's just like kind of embarrassing in a lot of ways. But back then it was a very Boston thing. And the guy called a goal scorer a playmaker. And they revolted. And Dave's like, I can't have you anymore. And this was back so long ago, Dave would put a blog out and the headline would be looking for a Bruins blogger. And I threw a blog in, and in typical Dave fashion, didn't hear back from him. And all of a sudden my blog was out there on the internet. And it was like, holy shit. You know, I was like a journalism major, and that's like an equivalent of a byline. So I was doing that for years and years, trying to get paid as a writer. And then Ryan Whitney, who I knew casually through mutual acquaintances, he came home from playing hockey professionally, and he said, I want to start one of these podcast things. And he tagged Biz in it, and Biz says, I'm playing for a few more years. And I kind of half-jokingly replied, saying, hey, looking for a partner. And Whit slid into my DMs right away and said, you know how to podcast? I says, no idea. I'll learn. And within 2 months, we had our first episode out. A couple months after that, Dave listened. To my surprise, he said, we like it. We want to sign you. So I was trying to get paid with my hands all those years. It turned out to be my big mouth was my moneymaker. So
that's right.
Yeah. So I've been doing the podcast for 5 years now.
It's so funny. Okay. So tell what you did before you became a full-time person.
I had every shitty job you can imagine. I worked probably for the two most hated state agencies you can imagine, the Department of Social Services. I didn't take people's kids out of the house, okay. By the way. It was a desk monkey job. And, Registry of Motor Vehicles, I had a job there too. Like, again, nothing. I was like the main offices. And I was a school custodian. That was my last job before I went full time here. So I know what it's like to have a miserable job. So when I have an off day here, you got to remind yourself.
Yeah, everything's
relative. You're not cleaning fucking toilets anymore. Pardon my French. But so, you know, I have instant check. Yeah, I could check myself pretty quickly.
I like that. It was so funny. So you two had that podcast. I would hear from you, what, like once every 6 months? It was, I feel like I would hear every so often and you would be like, hey, you guys paying me? Could you pay me? I appreciate the stick with itness though.
Yeah. I mean, every year, like I was talking to, like, I think Dante the other night, like me and Dave would butt heads every September and always creative. It was never personal with Dave. So that's why it always stayed on that level. You know, every June I'll be like, all right, I'm done. I ain't doing this anymore. Then September rolls around. It's like, fuck, man, I got to write about the Bruins on the internet. What am I going to get my own site and take my own ball and go home and have no audience? So, you know, I could have just gave up many times. And as I was doing that, I realized later, like, that was building up my credibility with someone like Whitney. Because, yeah. I mean, he wouldn't partner up with someone who thought it was a dipshit talking about hockey. I mean, he probably thinks I'm a dipshit in other ways. Feeling's pretty mutual.
Affirmative.
But, like, you know, it was like, he'd realize, all right, this kid knows what he's talking about enough that he was willing to pair up with me for a podcast. So I was kind of slowly building toward that, even if it wasn't part of some master plan.
How do you think Barstool's changed?
Lots of ways. I mean, I think we've expanded our reach. So it's like, you know, I know old school guys cry, oh, it's not what it used to be. It's like, no, we're still that. We're just offering other things to other people. Like, we've increased our audiences, which obviously we want to do as a growing company. So I think we've extended our reach and the different audiences we reach. But I think at the core of what we do, what Dave does, is always there. And I've made this comparison a million times. I know other people have probably heard it and sick of it, but I grew up reading Mad Magazine and National Lampoon and all that stuff. And there's just always kind of a rebellious spirit of like kind of pushing the envelope First Amendment wise and your freedom of speech. Not just doing it just to be a dick, to do it to have some fun and some laughs. So that was always kind of my approach with Barstool, was like, you know, you need somebody out there to kind of be not to be offensive or rude for that sake, but to like, hey, like to go out and put yourself out there. And that spirit of Barstool is still always there.
I love that. Okay, so Ari, I heard you want to go to Ireland.
Yes. Okay, pitch time. Yeah, me and Latch, we talked about it, kind of shooting the shit a few months back.
Were you drunk shooting the shit or no?
No, I don't think we were in person, so probably no. Well, okay. Anyway, I can't speak for Latch.
Okay,
so
fine. All right.
I can speak for myself. But, yeah, we just figured, you know, we see, you know, other coworkers take trips here and there, and they, you know, they basically, like Randy says, they'll throw a pitch out, say this is what we want to do. So me and Lodge, actually, I wrote a bunch of shit in my laptop, but basically we could fly into either Shannon or Dublin. I think me and Lodge are two very strong personalities that people generally like. He's kind of like the Boston version of me. I'm sort of like he's the
New
Brooklyn
York
version of
yeah.
me. I'm sort of the Boston version of him. Two old guys, little carrying a little extra in the middle, bald glasses. We kind of look like brothers. So I think if you flew us to Ireland and we just kind of woke up and had an adventure every day, I mean, I could list 15, 20 different places we could potentially go. But I think if we got a proper sponsor and that would willing to, you know, however that works, I don't know, Granola usually handles all that shit, and say, all right, if we get a sponsor, I think it would be a no-brainer to send
What's
us.
What's the pitch to the sponsor?
You're going to have two funny guys go around eating, drinking on mostly the west of Ireland and go to all these little hole-in-the-wall spots. I think you can make a plan, but I think somewhere, place like Ireland, it's okay, almost like you wake up and go to a pub, and then something might happen that day where if you got the cameras running, you can get
some
gold content.
So it's like, hey, why don't you send us to go get drunk for 2 weeks and be on camera?
Well, that was my original thought, but Lodge can't do 2 weeks, so it's more like 5-6 days.
Oh,
so
compressed,
it's
compressed
very,
drinking
very
schedule.
More compressed than I originally planned. But even so, I think we, you know, we can go there, and whether we want to bomb around and drive 4 hours a day or just kind of stay in one little area. I've been to Ireland. Obviously, his parents are from there. I think there's tons of potential to like for good content.
Okay.
You know, again, I.
What do you think that Dave Portnoy would say to this pitch?
Probably want a little more detail on it, you know. But I think, yeah, I mean, like I said, I could literally name 17 places, but you got, you know, a bunch of Irish names. I mean, we can go to the Cliffs of Moher, like up to Donegal, Dublin, obviously. There's the Guinness Factory.
That sounds like a great vacation for
you. Yeah, I mean, but that's the thing. It's not really a vacation. Have you been to Ireland?
I have not been to Ireland.
If you're driving and you're the one in Ireland, it's not a vacation at all. Now, obviously, we have a cameraman. What would make him drive? But it's like it's a lot of travel. It's like, you know, it's fun and adventure and all that. But it's, you know, it gets to be a grind when you know, drive it across the country.
Do you remember when Riggs went to London? Do you remember this? So when I first got here, my first week, I think Riggs was in London and he had the he had like an American jumpsuit on. And I was trying to make sense of Barstool and just like who was who. And Dave, there was no list of who worked here. So it was like it was just trying to figure it out. And I just remember being like, what the fuck?
I forgot about that. Yeah, that kind of put Riggs on the map quite a
bit.
It
did. And then he fooled everybody. He was covering Brexit.
Yeah, and he fooled everybody because he had sunglasses on.
Yes.
And then everybody saw him come out and was like, oh, okay. That's Riggs.
All right, so you want to do the same thing.
He was kind of more of a man on the street thing, I think, with his thing. And that was a very
unique. Oh, do you want to do man on the street or no?
No, no. I mean, we could possibly do it. I think what he was there for was kind of set up for man on the street thing.
Yep.
But I think we could, like, wake up, go to...
Like vlog actually, style. You know what? Okay, got it. Let's get your pitch there.
No, I actually stole Lodge's quote because that's why I brought my laptop in.
Oh, okay, let's do this. Let's get real. Yeah.
Where is it?
Do you want me to hold that for you? Yeah, here, I can help you with that.
Seriously. Just came together very quick.
Do you have the pass 123 password?
It's not too far from
that. Yeah, that's everybody's password.
Okay, so use Lodge's words. I think it would make for some charming video diary. So,
okay.
Yeah, I think me and Lodge play well together. It's our ancestral homeland, and it's like a place of adventure. There's like a spirit of adventure when you
go
there.
So maybe we should pitch it to like the Ireland Tourism Board.
That wouldn't be a bad idea,
right?
Two American mix over there might not be what they want. Like, yeah, here we go.
No, they would. They want that's who they want to come over.
I mean, I'd be down for it. Here we go. Cliftonmore, Doolin, Aran Islands, Killarney, Ringakerry, Dingle Peninsula, Tralee, Galway, West Cork, Lodge's Aunt's Farm. The island his dad was born on, Kinsale, Donegal, and then that's not even including Dublin, which has Jameson and Guinness Tours, National Museum of Ireland, Croke Park and Museum, Dunleary, all the pubs there, all the restaurants.
Okay. So, are you sharing a room, or do I have to book two hotel rooms?
We're not going European vacation style here.
Oh, okay.
Griswold. No, I mean, yeah, depending on who goes. And then this is a late one.
Okay.
This is a late one last night. I was with Chief last night, and his ears perked up when I heard it. I was like, Chief, I'll throw your name out there.
Chief wants to go now, too?
Again, I'm just throwing that out there because I love
Chief. It's like the large white guy vacation.
We're going to make Chief shave his head bald.
Large bald white guy vacation.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. But no, I all joking aside, I think it's rich for stuff over there. I mean, there's, again, a list of 15 places right there we can do.
Are you going to actually blog?
Yeah, over there, yeah. Oh, is that a dig?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, okay.
I don't think you or Large blog that much.
Okay, I blog more than Large, but no, I'm only kidding. I probably more? Yeah, I think everyone could probably
You're a great
do a little
blogger.
More. Thank you,
I
appreciate it.
You're one of my favorite
it.
Bloggers, I miss you.
Thank you, I appreciate that, and I wish I
You do
did
have
more
an amazing
too.
Voice, too.
Thank you. Yeah, my wife might disagree, but.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, I love it. How's Chiclets going?
It's going... Can I swear? Fucking awesome. Of course I can swear in front of you. It's great. I mean, I would have, like, again, I was pushing a broom in a public school five, six years ago. And, you know, now I'm talking to Hall of Famers on almost a weekly basis and getting paid for it. So I pinch myself every day.
That's awesome. All right. Thanks, R.A.
Absolutely.
Appreciate this.
No,
I'll get
pleasure.
Back to you on your pitch.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know that wasn't probably the most formal.
No, it's at least you have something written down, which is impressive.
Probably more than most people.
All right, before we get into Ezra and collectible and essentially the democratization of asset classes and the way that people will own shares of things, let's talk first about those are things that actually seem cool. I think people think owning things are cool. Ezra probably thinks his company's pretty cool. So anyways, you'll hear more about it. But before we talk about that, as it relates to looking cool, or if you just want to go incognito, I highly recommend Shady Rays. Shady Rays, I'm telling you, I do not leave my kitchen without grabbing my Shady Rays. They're so sturdy. I feel like they can withstand most anything, including the sun. And they also look great. So what's awesome about Shady Rays is they make incredibly high quality sunglasses. There's a great selection. I have actually wearing the big cat glasses, which are probably too big on my face and they make my nose look big. But I love them because I think they just make me disappear. You could be looking to disappear. You can be looking to have fashion. You could be looking for function. You can be looking for a better version of Ray-Bans. What's awesome about Shady Rays is they make very high quality, cool sunglasses. They're at very affordable prices. Their warranty is awesome and one of the best in the business. So go to ShadyRays.com. If you get two or more pairs of sunglasses, you can get 50% off by using code TOKEN. All right, hit me. Tell us who you are and what you do and what your company is.
You got it. I'm Ezra Levine. I'm the CEO of Collectible. Collectible is the number one sports fractional ownership platform. So effectively what we do is we take the most iconic sports memorabilia items and collectible items, and we literally make them affordable and digestible and liquid and diversified for people, right? So a quick example would be last night. We just broke a record last night. So I love coming on podcasts and breaking little news,
absolutely.
Right? So last night we IPO'd a Wilt Chamberlain 1959-1960 rookie home full uniform from his Philadelphia Warriors season, a $1.275 million item, right?
Okay.
So without collectible, that item would have sold at an auction house. It would have been purchased by probably a wealthy collector in New York or California. Really what we did is we IPO'd this to over 1,000 sports fans. So now 1,000 sports fans are the owners of this jersey and can, you know, not only say that they own it, which is a pretty cool thing to say.
So they own a piece of it.
They own shares in it, just like you would own shares in Penn Gaming, right?
Yep.
So same
and
way.
And where does the jersey live?
The jersey is stored in a vault. We have vaults all across the country, so it's fully insured and maintained and protected and all that stuff. But yeah, in the same way how you can buy Penn shares of Penn stock in the public markets, you can now buy shares of some of the most iconic blue chip sports collectibles through collectible.
Okay, I love that. So how do I get liquid? I buy my share. So you're creating a marketplace around collectible items, right?
That's correct.
So I buy my share of the Wilt Chamberlain jersey. And how big is the marketplace for me to sell it?
So we have, imagine a little stock market for sports collectibles.
Okay.
So we're the first fractional company who has a continuous market.
Okay.
Right? So these trade 5 days a week. You can go on the collectible platform and put in bids and offers for this. And so right now we have a community of about 31,000 sports collectors and investors, fairly liquid. I do anticipate that it'll get even more liquid over time as we get more and more users. We just launched in September of last year. You can put in orders to buy and sell shares in these high-value collectibles.
Okay, I love it. It's so interesting because I was thinking that you're like StockX for collectibles in some way, but it's interesting, this the NFT business is just so virtual, right? The idea of owning something without having something, which I think is very generational. I think there's something to current, young, and future generations who will not need to physically own something. So tell me, how do you see the collectible space, the NFT space? Are you and all the other collectible auction houses, like, are you in Golden? Who do you compete with? Do you compete with Golden? Like, who are you competing with?
Yeah, you know, I would say we don't compete with anyone aside from ourselves, right? So our job is really just put on the best possible product that we can. I think, you know, our vision for this is that we're creating something that really has never been created before. There are some, you know, easy comparables of companies in the fractional space. One's Rally Road. One is a company called Otis, right? I would say we somewhat compete with auction houses in the sense where we're all going after iconic blue chip collectible
items. How does that process work? Like, how are you getting the Chamberlain jersey?
Relationships, right? And so, you know, it's such a relationship-driven business. We took a very purposefully differentiated approach to building out our cap table, all the investors in the parent company, right? We just went to some of the biggest collections and collectors and investors in the category, explained what we were doing, our vision for it, and we got the buy-in from some of the biggest collections in the world.
So the collection houses own all this shit, right? Is that how it goes?
Well, it's a pretty concentrated group of people who own this stuff, right?
Okay.
So, you know, the thing that really surprised us, but also was our opportunity, right, is that a lot of the best stuff are held in not that many hands, right? So if you can convince the people who own the stuff to consign it through you, to use you when you want to get liquidity, then you're in business, right? So our thought was build relationships on the supply side with people who have these collectible items. And the rest kind of takes care of itself. It's obviously never that simple. But, you know, we as of now, we've done about $50 million worth of consignments in our first 7 months. Through our partnerships, we have hundreds of millions of dollars of iconic sports supply, which we plan on bringing to the market when our user base, you know, sort of catches up to it a little bit.
Why wouldn't they create their own collectible?
Well, it's not so easy to do, right? So we're an SEC regulated and qualified business, right? So ultimately what we're doing is we're selling securities. We literally make these collectible items into companies and we sell them to the public, right? So again, when you're buying shares of stuff on collectible, you're pretty much buying shares in Facebook or Apple or Amazon or Google, but instead you're buying Mickey Mantle and Michael Jordan. And so, you know, it's a pretty regulatory intensive process. And, you know, we think that we've learned how to do that at scale.
But scale's what, 31,000 people?
So far.
That's not scale.
It's a rapidly growing community.
Okay, okay. You've got very good answers.
We expect 31,000 turned to 310,000 quickly.
Okay, got it. And what's your end game for Collectible? Like, how long have you guys been in business?
Well, we launched publicly in September of 2020. Okay. So since then, we've done about 91 IPOs.
Okay.
Again, you know, under consignment, we've got $50 million worth of stuff. Through partnerships, anywhere between, you know, almost a $500 million worth of high-end sports collectibles. That's hard to do, right? It would take someone, you know, a lot of time and relationships to kind of recreate what we've created on mm-hmm. the supply side.
Mm-hmm.
And really what we're doing now is we're building up our user base to the point where it's a fully liquid, fully efficient marketplace. And we're incredibly excited about that.
And do you have to give the collectible houses a guarantee? Like, how do you get the jersey over the next guy besides the fact that they have that they're invested in you or they like you?
Well, so we've done a couple of really interesting, innovative things, right? So we were the first company that created what we call retained ownership, right?
Okay.
So if you take one step back, prior to collectible, the only way to sell collectible items, right, or memorabilia or card items, was to sell 100% of it through an auction house or through eBay.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of selling partial equity or selling, you know, not the whole item, never existed before. So we pioneered that, right? So people can now sell 50% of something and retain 50% ownership to hopefully capture additional upside over time. So that has been something which was a huge boon to our business.
And that's a differentiator for you or your sector.
Yeah, I think
fractionals.
I think early on it was something that gave us a huge leg up.
Yeah.
And then from there, you know, we just provide a best-in-class experience. You know, one key metric we look at is the repeat consignment rate, right? So if someone gives us an opportunity, what percentage of those consigners and suppliers are coming back to us again?
So he's right? Like, I got, you know, the Larry Bird jersey, and I've got, okay, I like that.
So, you know, we've now worked with 54 unique suppliers or consigners. Of those 54, 47 have already come back to us with additional supply, right? So to me, that suggests that not only are we good at building relationships, but we're good at keeping those relationships and, you know, giving people reasons to trust us versus other companies in the space.
And how are you getting more audience? How are you creating demand?
Well, doing podcasts like this, obviously, is one of them. You know, our user base really is pretty much all organically driven so far. Right, it's people who just, you know, love sports collectibles and know what they're doing. You know, we tend to think that our intersection is, you know, really a combination of sort of the daily fantasy sports gambling crowd meets sort of the financial markets crowd, right? So meets the Robin Hoods, the Fidelities, the Schwabs, people who are interested in alternative asset investing, right? I think this is one thing which has really propelled the sports collectibles category. Is like, it lives at this intersection of being just something that sports fans love and appreciate, and everyone has great associations with sports. And it's now being looked at as a real sort of financial asset. People are looking to diversify in all different types of things, right? And when you look historically, sports collectibles at the high end have just been an incredible place to park your money. That's no guarantee or no projection of future returns, of course. But historically, this has been an unbelievable place to invest. The problem has been, it's just never been affordable or available.
So we're
sort of knocking down the barrier to entry. We're democratizing the category in ways that's never been done before.
Okay, so this is basically a product for your educated white guy, lives probably in a city and is 28. Is that right? And grew up watching sports with his dad.
Well, we hit a really cool milestone about 2 weeks ago. We have users in all 50 states in America.
Okay, that's great.
Our average user is, in the upper 20s, low 30s, yeah. Predominantly male audience. We're hoping to get into the female demographic soon. We're doing some women's sports IPOs, some Serena Williams, some WNBA stuff. We fully expect that this is not just an all male play, but, you know, sort of men and women would be interested. And, you know, we think this is a big, massive global opportunity as well.
Yep. Okay. And you were a Wall Street guy before you did this. Like, how did you get into this?
Well, you know, I've been around, as we affectionately call it, the hobby for a long time.
Oh,
right?
The hobby. Were you a collector?
I was a collector in the sense where pretty much every boy in America who grew up, you know, in the 90s collected sports cards, right? So I was a collector in that sense. My dad was a big collector.
Okay.
Actually, the Chamberlain, here's a little inside baseball. The Chamberlain jersey, which we IPO'd last night, right? My dad actually owned that at one point, way back in the day.
Oh, you're
not,
like, Dad,
it was not nearly as valuable as it is now. But
okay.
You know, he owned it. I remember seeing it when I was a kid in the house. He sold it because he was a father of three kids and he lived in New York and needed money, of course. Yeah. And then traded hands. But, you know, yeah, so I grew up around the industry just through my dad. And I followed the industry. And, you know, what I saw was there was something happening in sports collectibles really, you know, back in 2015 is really when it began. There was just, you know, more attention coming, more scarcity. The grading agencies became a lot more sophisticated. Things were more standardized, right? A lot of the bad actors and, you know, sort of bad situations started to evolve. There was sort of a, you know, a pickup in sentiment and prices. But really what I saw was a very fragmented industry where it was pricing out pretty much anyone, unless you were supremely wealthy. Mm-hmm. You could not participate. And there was a huge sort of breakdown of where, you know, the real financial returns were taking place.
The demand and the supply were concentrated. I think that's like the last 24
months. Hugely concentrated in very few hands. Mm-hmm. And there was, again, a real bifurcation on the financial side, right? People were making a ton of money in sports collectibles, but only if you could afford the upper echelon of stuff, the blue chip stuff. Yeah. And unless you were one of those few wealthy people who could do that, you were priced out, right?
And is it a brag or is it a good investment? Like I think about, you know, I have Robinhood, right? Like I would buy a shit ton of Penn stock today. I know that I'll get a financial return. I know how that return will come back to me. Same with Bitcoin. You know, you can see the same with crypto. Is this a brag or is it a good investment or is it both? Or is it too soon to tell?
Right. So, you know, look, we always say this is the perfect intersection of passion and profits. We say that all the time, right?
Okay.
Again, you know, I try to be very careful with my words, right?
So
there's no guarantee of future returns.
Sure. Disclaimers,
all that good stuff. Historically speaking, I'll speak historically, right, because that's factual. There are a couple indices which suggest that high-end sports collectibles have dramatically outcomped more traditional investments like the stock market. There's one index which suggests since 2008 the high-end sports card market has outperformed stocks by 500%. 500%, right? Even you know, if you go a little step down, right, the top 2,500 sports cards have outperformed the market by well over 100%. Right. So again, historically, this has been a really attractive asset class. In finance speak, it's also been, you know, uncorrelated to the broader markets, meaning that, you know, when the market goes down,
it
these
exists
things,
in its own world.
Correct. And, you know, it tends to go down less, or occasionally what we've seen, you know, throughout COVID, sports collectibles actually had a dramatic rise in price, right? So, you know, I think that sort of, you know, that brag factor, as you said, that sort of cool factor and emotional appeal probably is part of what has made this one of the better investments, right? It's just people love it and they understand it. And when times get tough, they're less likely to sell this because, you know,
because they have an emotional connection to it. I wonder, I think what's interesting about it is the whole thing is predicated on desire and want, right? And the perception that the Jordan jersey, that he's the GOAT, and there's a scarcity to it. There's a premium to it because it's in the past. It will never happen again. It's historic. I also wonder, is this a 10 to 12 year product? I'm curious to get your thoughts versus, like, what's the internet version of this? Like, I'll give you an example. So Dave has a show with Josh Richards called BFFs, and we play a game on the show called Boomer Zoomer. And Dave will put up a picture of Wilt Chamberlain, and Josh Richards is like, who the fuck is that? You know what I mean? So there's something in the, you know, I was having this conversation today with someone here who works in talent, and, you know, he was saying, oh, hey, we need to go get a known brand, a known entity, a known person. And I was like, I'm not sure. I think you need to go into TikTok and find, you know, known, but for in a world that none of us have eyes for. So how do you see that? Like, will you get into esports? Are you starting to think about collectibles that come from a different era than, let's say, you or I are attuned to?
Yeah, I mean, look, our job is to really have our finger on the pulse, right, of trends and athletes that are historically and culturally relevant. Obviously, that does change over time. You know, we've seen both a resurgence of modern athletes, guys who are still playing, And we've also seen a resurgence of vintage, right? It's been kind of interesting. And, you know, our product is something that we think could really appeal to people of all ages, right? Again, we have people on the platform who are more of that Schwab Fidelity crowd. And then we have other people who are more of the Robinhood crowd, right? And that appeals to, you know, to a lot of different types of people. So again, our job is really just to have our finger on the pulse, identify opportunities, and to present those opportunities to our user base when they come.
And how do you make money? You take a percentage fee?
We take a commission off of the successful completion of these IPOs, okay, and then a transaction fee on the secondary market.
Okay, got it. Okay, that's great. And how many people work for Collectible? Brand is great. I love the
thank
brand.
Thank you. Thank you. We're a small, scrappy team. Okay. We're growing quickly. So I think we have 11 full-time employees at the moment.
And based here in New York?
Remote.
So
this really kind of took
off.
You're
a pandemic company.
We are. Well, so this really took off really during the pandemic. Yeah. And we've been able to hire really talented people all across the country, actually all across the world. We have people in London as well.
And how do you, as the CEO, keep them connected? Like
virtually, right? So I mean, Zoom and Slack and all that stuff. It's been. Look, I think it takes having the right people on the team. Right? You got to have real self starters who are motivated. Obviously, there is a little process lost when everything's all remote. But I think it also allows you to hire and retain some of the best talent who appreciate that. Sort of added flexibility.
Did you have someone who started this with you, or did you do it yourself?
We had a co-founder named Jason Epstein, so he's very much involved in the business as well.
Okay, that's great. Do you have any women?
We do. We have three women part of the
team. Love it. All
right.
Three women. Just want to hear that. Okay, so tell people where they download you, find you, give the pitch on if you want a collectible and you want to be part of an IPO of an item, where they find you, how
sure.
they get you.
Sure. You can download our app. So we're app only at the moment, iOS and Android. Collectible with an A, right? Collectable. You can also go visit our website, www.collectible.com. And you can find us all over social media as well.
Awesome. All right. Thanks for coming in, Ezra. This
Erica.
Was great. I appreciate it. All right.
Thanks for listening to this episode. We appreciate everybody who listens to this show. You can now find us on YouTube. We're doing this as a video. So if you're not watching us, you could be. Not to say that's a great experience, but whatever. I'm at EKA Nardini. Token CEO is on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and TikTok. We'll see you back here on Thursday, and we'll go from there.